Or, I said, what do you want? Really want?
You, he said, you and her, that we become free at this crossroads.
Not that we surrender to you? I shook my head, and I saw the same wariness and recoiling in Gabriel. He was not angry. There was no malice now. Yet he said again, in the same beguiling voice, I curse you. And I felt as if he'd declaimed it.
I offered myself to you at the moment you vanquished me, he said. Remember that when your dark children strike out at you, when they rise up against you. Remember me.
I was shaken, more shaken even than I had been in the sad and awful finish with Nicholas at Renault's. I had never once known fear in the crypt under Les Innocents, but I had known it in this room since we came in. And some anger boiled in him again, something too dreadful for him to control. I watched him bow his head and turn away. He became small, light, and held his arms close to himself as he stood before the blaze, and he thought of threats now to hurt me, and I heard them though they died before they ever reached his lips. But something disturbed my vision for a fraction of a second. Maybe it was a candle guttering. Maybe it was the blink of my eye. Whatever it was, he vanished. Or he tried to vanish, and I saw him leaping away from the fire in a great dark streak. No! I cried out, and lunging at something I couldn't even see, I held him, material again, in my hands. He had only moved very fast, and I had moved faster, and we stood facing each other in the doorway of the crypt, and again I said that single negation, and I wouldn't let him go.
Not like this, we can't part. We can't leave each other in hatred. We can't.
And my will dissolved suddenly, as I embraced him and held tight to him so that he couldn't free himself or even move. I didn't care what he was, or what he had done in that doomed moment of lying to me, or even trying to overpower me. I didn't care that I was no longer mortal and would never be again. I wanted only that he should remain. I wanted to be with him, what he was, and all the things he had said were true. Yet it could never be as he wished it to be. He could not have this power over us. He could not divide Gabriel from me. Yet I wondered, did he himself really understand what he was asking? Was it possible that he believed the more innocent words he spoke? Without speaking, without asking his consent, I led him back to the bench by the fire. I felt danger again, terrible danger, but it didn't really matter. He had to remain here with us now. Gabrielle was murmuring to herself. She was walking back and forth, and her cloak hung from one shoulder, and she seemed almost to have forgotten we were there. Armand watched her, and when she turned to him, quite suddenly and unexpectedly, she spoke aloud.
You come to him and you say, take me with you. You say, love me. And you hint of superior knowledge, secrets, yet you give us nothing, either of us, except lies.
I showed my power to understand, he answered in a soft murmur.
No, you did tricks with your understanding, she replied. You made pictures, and rather childish pictures. You have done this all along. You lure Lestat in the palais with the most gorgeous illusions only to attack him. And here, when there is a respite in the struggle, what do you do but try to sow dissension between us?
Yes, illusions before, I admit it, he answered. But the things I've spoken here are true. Already you despise your son for his love of mortals, his need to be ever near them, his yielding to the violinist. You knew the dark gift would madden that one, and that it will finally destroy him. You do wish for your freedom from all the children of darkness. You can't hide that from me.
Ah, but you're so simple, she said. You see, but you don't see. How many mortal years did you live? Do you remember anything of them? What you've perceived is not the sum total of the passion I feel for my son. I have loved him as I have never loved any other being in creation. In my loneliness, my son is everything to me. How is it you can't interpret what you see?
"It's you who fail to interpret," he answered in the same soft manner. "If you had ever felt real longing for any other one, you would know that what you feel for your son is nothing at all."
"This is futile," I said, "to talk like this."
"No," she said to him without the slightest wavering, "my son and I are kin to each other in more ways than one. In 50 years of life, I've never known anyone as strong as myself except my son. And what divides us, we can always mend. But how are we to make you one of us when you use these things like wood for fire? But understand my larger point. What is it of yourself that you can give that we should want you?"
"My guidance is what you need," he answered. "You've only begun your adventure, and you have no beliefs to hold you. You cannot live without some guidance.
Millions live without belief or guidance. It is you who cannot live without it," she said.
Pain coming from him. Suffering. But she went on, her voice so steady and without expression that it was almost a monologue.
"I have my questions," she asked. "There are things I must know. I cannot live without some embracing philosophy, but it has nothing to do with old beliefs in gods or devils."
She started pacing again, glancing to him as she spoke.
"I want to know, for example, why beauty exists," she said, "why nature continues to contrive it, and what is the link between the life of a lightning storm with the feelings these things inspire in us? If God does not exist, if these things are not unified into one metaphorical system, then why do they retain for us such symbolic power? Lestat calls it a savage garden, but for me that is not enough. And I must confess that this maniacal curiosity, or call it what you will, leads me away from my human victims. It leads me into the open countryside, away from human creation. And maybe it will lead me away from my son, who is under the spell of all things human."
She came up to him, nothing in her manner suggesting a woman now, and she narrowed her eyes as she looked into his face.
"But that is the lantern by which I see the devil's road," she said. "By what lantern have you travelled it? What have you really learned besides devil worship and superstition? What do you know about us, and how we came into existence? Give that to us, and it might be worth something. And then again, it might be worth nothing."
He was speechless. He had no art to hide his amazement. He stared at her in innocent confusion. Then he rose and he slipped away, obviously trying to escape her, a battered spirit as he stared blankly before him. The silence closed in, and I felt for the moment strangely protective for him. She had spoken the unadorned truth about the things that interested her, as had been her custom ever since I could remember. And as always, there was something violently disregarding about it. She spoke of what mattered to her with no thought of what had befallen him. "Come to a different plane," she had said, "my plane," and he was stymied and belittled. The degree of his helplessness was becoming alarming. He was not recovering from her attack. He turned, and he moved towards the benches again, as if he would sit, then towards the sarcophagi, then towards the wall. It seemed these solid surfaces repelled him as though his will confronted them first in an invisible field, and he was buffeted about. He drifted out of the room and into the narrow stone stairwell, and then he turned and came back. His thoughts were locked inside himself, or, worse, there were no thoughts. There were only the tumbling images of what he saw before him, simple material things glaring back at him, the iron-studded door, the candles, the fire, some full-blown evocation of the Paris streets, the vendors and the hawkers of papers, the cabriolets, the blended sound of an orchestra, a horrid din of words and phrases from the books he had so recently read. I couldn't bear this, but Gabrielle gestured sternly that I should stay where I was. Something was building in the crypt. Something was happening in the very air itself. Something changed even as the candles melted, and the fire crackled and licked at the blackened stones behind it, and the rats moved in the chambers of the dead below. Armand stood in the arched doorway, and it seemed hours had passed, though they hadn't, and Gabrielle was a long distance away in the corner of the room,
her face cool in its concentration, her eyes as radiant as they were small. Armand was going to speak to us. But it was no explanation he was going to give. There was no direction even to the things he would say, and it was as if we'd cut him open, and the images were coming out like blood. Armand was just a young boy in the doorway, holding the backs of his own arms. And I knew what I felt. It was a monstrous intimacy with another being, an intimacy that made even the rapt moments of the kill seem dim and under control. He was opened, and could no longer contain the dazzling stream of pictures that made his old silent voice seem thin and lyrical and made up. Had this been the danger all along, the trigger of my fear? Even as I recognized it, I was yielding, and it seemed the great lessons of my life had all been learned through the renunciation of fear. Fear was once again breaking the shell around me so that something else could spring to life. Never, never in all my existence, not mortal or immortal, had I been threatened with an intimacy quite like this. The Story of Armand. 3. The chamber had faded. The walls were gone. Horsemen came. A gathering cloud on the horizon, then screams of terror, and an auburn-haired child in crude peasant's clothes running on and on as a horseman broke loose in a horde, and the child fighting and kicking as he was caught and thrown over the saddle of a rider who bore him away beyond the end of the world. Armand was this child, and these were the southern steppes of Russia. But Armand didn't know it was Russia. He knew mother and father, and church, and God and Satan, but he didn't even understand the name of home, or the name of his language, or that the horsemen who carried him away were Tatars, and that he would never see anything that he knew or loved again. Darkness, the tumultuous movement of the ship and its never-ending sickness, and emerging out of the fear and the numbing despair, the vast, glittering wilderness of impossible buildings that was Constantinople in the last days of the Byzantine Empire, with her fantastical multitudes and her slave auction blocks. The menacing babble of foreign tongues, threats made in the universal language of gesture, and all around him the enemies he could not distinguish or placate or escape. Years and years would pass, beyond a mortal lifetime, before Armand would look back on that awesome moment and give them names and histories. The Byzantine officials of the courts, who would have castrated him, and the harem-keepers of Islam who would have done the same, and the proud Mamluk warriors of Egypt who would have taken him to Cairo with them had he been fairer and stronger, and the radiant, soft-spoken Venetians in their leggings and velvet doublets, the most dazzling creatures of all, Christians, even as he was a Christian, yet laughing gently to one another as they examined him, as he stood mute, unable to answer, to plead, even to hope. I saw the seas before him, the great rolling blue of the Aegean and the Adriatic, and his sickness again in the hold, and his solemn vow not to live. And then the great Moorish palaces of Venice rising from the gleaming surface of the lagoon, and the house to which he was taken, with its dozens and dozens of secret chambers, the light of the sky glimpsed only through barred windows, and the other boys speaking to him in that soft, strange tongue that was Venetian, and the threats and the cajoling as he was convinced against all his fear and superstitions of the sins that he must commit with the endless procession of strangers in this landscape of marble and torchlight, each chamber opening to a new tableau of tenderness that surrendered to the same ritual and inexplicable and finally cruel desire. And at last, one night, when, for days and days, he had refused to submit, and he was hungry and sore, and would not speak any longer to anyone, he was pushed through one of those doors again, just as he was, soiled and blind from the dark room in which he'd been locked, and the creature standing there to receive him, the tall one in red velvet, with a lean and almost luminous face, touched him so gently with cool fingers that, half-dreaming, he didn't cry as he saw the coins exchange hands. But it was a great deal of money. Too much money. He was being sold off. and the face, it was too smooth, it might have been a mask. At the final moment, he screamed. He swore he would obey, he wouldn't fight any more. Will someone tell him where he's being taken? He won't disobey any more, please, please. But even as he was pulled down the stairs towards the dank smell of the water, he felt the firm, delicate fingers of his new master again, and on his neck, cool and tender lips that could never, never hurt him, and that first, deadly and irresistible kiss. Love, and love, and love in the vampire kiss. It bathed Armand, cleansed him. This is everything, as he was carried into the gondola, and the gondola moved like a great sinister beetle through the narrow stream into the sewers beneath another house. Drunk on pleasure, drunk on the silky white hands that smoothed back his hair, and the voice that called him beautiful, on the face that in moments of feeling was suffused with expression, only to become as serene and dazzling as something made of jewels and alabaster in repose. Like a pool of moonlit water it was. Touch it, even with a fingertip, and all its life rises to the surface, only to vanish in quiet once again. Drunk in the morning light on the memory of those kisses, as, alone, he opened one door after another upon books and maps and statues in granite and marble, the other apprentice finding him and leading him patiently to his work, letting him watch as they ground the brilliant pigments, teaching him to blend the pure colour with the yellow egg yolk, and how to spread the lacquer of the egg yolk over the panels, and taking him up on the scaffolding as they worked with careful strokes on the very edges of the vast depiction of sun and clouds, showing him those great faces and hands and angels' wings which only the master's brush would touch. Drunk, as he sat at the long table with them, gorging himself on the delicious foods that he had never tasted before, and the wine which never ran out. And falling asleep finally, to wake at that moment of twilight, when the master stood beside the enormous bed, gorgeous as something imagined in his red velvet, with his thick, white hair glistening in the lamplight, and the simplest happiness in his brilliant cobalt-blue eyes. The deadly kiss.
"Ah, yes, never to be separated from you. Yes, not afraid.
Soon, my darling one, we will be truly united soon." Torches blazing throughout the house, the master atop the scaffolding with a brush in his hand. "Stand there in the light. Don't move." And hours frozen in the same position, and then before dawn, seeing his own likeness there in the paint, the face of the angel, the master smiling as he moved down the endless corridor.
"No, master, don't leave me. Let me stay with you. Don't go."
Day again, and money in his pockets, real gold, and the grandeur of Venice with her dark green waterways, walled-in palaces, and the other apprentices walking arm in arm with him, and the fresh air and the blue sky over the Piazza San Marco, like something he had only dreamed in childhood, and the palazzo again at twilight, and the master coming. The master bent over the smaller panel with a brush, working faster and faster, as the apprentices gazed on, half horrified, half fascinated. The master looking up and seeing him, and putting down the brush, and taking him out of the enormous studio as the others worked until the hour of midnight. His face in the master's hands as, alone in the bedchamber again, that secret. Never tell anyone. Kiss. 2 years? 3 years? No words to recreate it or embrace it, the glory that was those times, the fleets that sailed away to war from that port, the hymns that rose before those Byzantine altars, the passion plays, and the miracle plays performed on their platforms in the churches and in the piazza with their hell's mouth and cavorting devils, and the glittering mosaics spreading out over the walls of San Marco and San Zanippolo and the Palazzo Ducale, and the painters who walked those streets, Giambono, Uccello, the Vivarini and the Bellini, and the endless feast days and processions, and always in the small hours in the vast, torch-lighted rooms of the palazzo, alone with the master when the others slept safely locked away. The master's brush, racing over the panel before it, as if uncovering the painting rather than creating it, sun and sky and sea spreading out beneath the canopy of the angel's wings, and those awful, inevitable moments when the master would rise screaming, hurling the pots of paint in all directions, clutching at his eyes as if he would pull them out of his head. Why can I not see? Why can I not see better than mortals see? Holding tight to the master, waiting for the rapture of the kiss, dark secret, unspoken secret, the master slipping out of the door some time before dawn.
Let me go with you, master.
Soon, my darling, my love, my little one, when you're strong enough and tall enough, and there is no flaw in you any more. Go now and have all the pleasures that await you, have the love of a woman, and have the love of a man as well in the nights that follow. Forget the bitterness you knew in the brothel, and taste of these things while there is still time. And rarely did the night close that there wasn't that figure come back again, just before the rising sun, and this time ruddy and warm as it bent over him to give him the embrace that would sustain him through the daylight hours until the deadly kiss at twilight again. He learned to read and write. He took the paintings to their final destinations in the churches and the chapels of the great palaces, and collected the payments, and bargained for the pigments and the oils. He scolded the servants when the beds weren't made and the meals weren't ready, and beloved by the apprentices, he sent them to their new service when they were finished, with tears. He read poetry to the master as the master painted, and he learned to play the lute and to sing songs. And during those sad times when the master left Venice for many nights, it was he who governed in the master's absence, concealing his anguish from the others, knowing it would end only when the master returned. And one night, finally, in the small hours when even Venice slept, "This is the moment, beautiful one, for you to come to me and become like me. Is it what you wish?" "Yes. Forever to thrive in secret upon the blood of the evildoer as I thrive, and to abide with these secrets until the end of the world.
I take the vow. I surrender. I will. To be with you, my master, always. You are the creator of all things that I am. There has never been any greater desire."
The master's brush pointing to the painting that reached to the ceiling above the tiers of scaffolding. "This is the only sun that you will ever see again, but a millennium of nights will be yours to see light as no mortal has ever seen it, to snatch from the distant stars as if you were Prometheus, an endless illumination by which to understand all things." How many months were thereafter, reeling in the power of the dark gift? This nighttime life of drifting through the alleyways and the canals together, at one with the danger of the dark and no longer afraid of it, and the age-old rapture of the killing, and never, never the innocent souls, no, always the evil-doer, the mind pierced until Typhon, the slayer of his brother, was revealed, and then the drinking up of the evil from the mortal victim, and the transmuting of it into ecstasy, the master leading the way, the feast shared. And the painting afterwards. The solitary hours with the miracle of the new skill, the brush sometimes moving as if by itself across the enameled surface, and the two of them painting furiously on the triptych, and the mortal apprentices asleep among the paint pots and the wine bottles, and only one mystery disturbing the serenity, the mystery that the master, as in the past, must now and then leave Venice for a journey that seemed endless to those left behind. All the more terrible now the parting, to hunt alone without the master, to lie alone in the deep cellar after the hunt, waiting, not to hear the ring of the master's laughter or the beat of the master's heart.
"But where do you go?
Why can't I go with you?" Armand pleaded. Didn't they share the secret? Why was this mystery not explained? "No, my lovely one, you are not ready for this burden. For now it must be, as it has been for over 1,000 years, mine alone. Some day you will help me with what I have to do, but only when you are ready for the knowledge, when you have shown that you truly wish to know, and when you are powerful enough that no one can ever take the knowledge from you against your will. Until then, understand, I have no choice but to leave you. I go to tend to those who must be kept, as I have always done. Those who must be kept. Armand brooded upon it. It frightened him. But worst of all, it took the master from him, and only did he learn not to fear it when the master returned to him again and again. Those who must be kept are in peace, or in silence, he would say as he took the red velvet cloak from his shoulders. More than that we may never know. And to the feast again, the stalking of the evil-doer through the alleys of Venice, he and the master would go. How long might it have continued? Through one mortal lifetime? Through 100? Not a half year in this dark bliss, before the evening at twilight when the master stood over his coffin in the deep cellar just above the water and said, "Rise, Armand, we must leave here. They have come. But who are they, master? Is it those who must be kept? No, my darling, it is the others. Come, we must hurry. But how can they hurt us? Why must we go?" The white faces at the windows, the pounding at the doors, glass shattering, the master turning this way and that as he looked at the paintings, the smell of smoke, the smell of burning pitch. They were coming up from the cellar. They were coming down from above. "Run! There is not time to save anything." Up the stairs to the roof. Black, hooded figures, heaving their torches through the doorways, the fire roaring in the rooms below, exploding the windows, boiling up the stairway. All the paintings were burning. "To the roof, Armand! Come!" Creatures like ourselves in these dark garments. Others like ourselves. The master scattered them in all directions as he raced up the stairway, bones cracking as they struck the ceiling and the walls. "Blasphemer! Heretic!" the alien voices roared. The arms caught Armand and held him, and above at the very top of the stairway the master turned back for him. "Armand, trust your strength! Come!" But they were swarming behind the master. They were surrounding him. For each one hurled into the plaster, three more appeared, until 50 torches were plunged into the master's velvet garments, his long red sleeves, his white hair. The fire roared up to the ceiling as it consumed him, making of him a living torch, even as with flaming arms he defended himself, igniting his attackers as they threw the blazing torches like firewood at his feet. But Armand was being borne down and away, out of the burning house, with the screaming mortal apprentices. And over the water, and away from Venice, amid cries and wailing, in the belly of a vessel as terrifying as the slave ship, to an open clearing under the night sky. "Blasphemer! Blasphemer!" the bonfire growing, and a chain of hooded figures around it, and the chant rising and rising. "Into the fire! No, don't do it to me! No!" And as he watched, petrified, he saw, brought towards the pyre, the mortal apprentices, his brothers, his only brothers, roaring in panic as they were hurled upwards and over into the flames. "No, stop this! They're innocent! For the love of God, stop! Innocent!" he was screaming, but now his time had come. They were lifting him as he struggled, and he was flung up and up to fall down into the blast. "Master, help me!" Then all words giving way to one wailing cry. Thrashing, screaming, mad. But he had been taken out of it, snatched back into life, and he lay on the ground looking at the sky. The flames licked the stars, it seemed, but he was far away from them, and couldn't feel the heat any more. He could smell his burnt clothing and his burnt hair. The pain in his face and hands was the worst, and the blood was leaking out of him, and he could scarcely move his lips. "All thy master's vain works destroyed, all the vain creations which he made among mortals with his dark powers, images of angels and saints and living mortals. Wilt thou too be destroyed, or serve Satan? Make thy choice. Thou hast tasted the fire, and the fire waits for thee, hungry for thee. Hell waits for thee. Wilt thou make thy choice?"
"Yes."
"To serve Satan as he is meant to be served?"
"Yes."
"That all things of the world are vanity, And thou shalt never use thy dark powers for any mortal vanity, not to paint, not to create music, not to dance, nor to recite for the amusement of mortals, but only and forever in the service of Satan, thy dark powers to seduce, and to terrify, and to destroy, only to destroy. Yes, consecrated to thy one and only master, Satan, Satan forever, always, and forever, to serve thy true master in darkness and pain and in suffering, to surrender thy mind and thy heart, yes, and to keep from thy brethren in Satan no secret, to yield all knowledge of the blasphemer and his burden. Silence. To yield all knowledge of the burden, child. Come now, the flames wait.
I do not understand you.
Those who must be kept. Tell.
Tell what? I do not know anything, except that I do not wish to suffer. I am so afraid.
The truth, child of darkness. Where are they? Where are those who must be kept?
I do not know. Look into my mind if you have that same power. There is nothing I can tell.
But what, child? What are they? Did he never tell you? What are those who must be kept?
And so they did not understand it either. It was no more than a phrase to them as it was to him.
When you are powerful enough that no one can ever take the knowledge from you against your will.
The master had been wise.
What is its meaning? Where are they? We must have the answer.
I swear to you, I do not have it. I swear on my fear, which is all I possess now. I do not know.
White faces appearing above him. One at a time, the tasteless lips giving hard, sweet kisses, hands stroking him, and from their wrists the glittering droplets of blood. They wanted the truth to come out in the blood, but what did it matter? The blood was the blood. Thou art the devil's child now.
Yes.
Don't weep for thy master, Marius. Marius is in hell where he belongs. Now drink the healing blood, and rise and dance with thine own kind for the glory of Satan, and immortality will be truly thine.
Yes, the blood burning his tongue as he lifted his head, the blood filling him with torturous slowness. Oh, please!
All around him Latin phrases, and a low beat of drums. They were satisfied. They knew he had spoken the truth. They would not kill him. And the ecstasy dimmed all considerations. The pain in his hands and his face had melted into this ecstasy. Rise, young one, and join the children of darkness.
Yes, I do.
White hands reaching for his hands, horns and lutes shrilling over the thud of the drums, the harps plucked into an hypnotic strumming as the circle commenced to move. Hooded figures in mendicant black, robes flowing as they lifted their knees high and bent their backs, and breaking hands, they whirled, leapt, and came down again, spinning round and round, and a humming song rose louder and louder from their closed lips. The circles swept on faster. The humming was a great melancholy vibration without shape or continuity, and yet it seemed to be a form of speaking, to be the very echo of thought. Louder and louder it came, like a moan that could not break into a cry. He was making the same sound with it, and then turning, and dizzy with turning, he leapt high into the air. Hands caught him, lips kissed him, and he was whirling about and pulled along by the others, someone crying out in Latin, another answering, another crying louder, and another answer coming again. He was flying. No longer bound to the earth, and the awful pain of his master's death, and the death of the paintings, and death of the mortals he loved. The wind sailed past him, and the heat blasted his face and eyes, but the singing was so beautiful that it didn't matter that he didn't know the words, or that he couldn't pray to Satan, didn't know how to believe or make such a prayer. No one knew that he didn't know. And they were all in a chorus together, and they cried and lamented and turned and leapt again, and then, swaying back and forth, threw their heads back as the fire blinded them and licked them, and someone shouted, "Yes! Yes!" And the music surged, A barbarous rhythm broke loose all around him from drums and tambourines, voices in lurid rushing melody at last. The vampires threw up their arms, howled, figures flickering past him in riotous contortions, backs arched, heels stomping. The jubilation of imps in hell. It horrified him, and it called to him. And when the hands clutched at him and swung him around, he stomped and twisted and danced like the others, letting the pain course through him, bending his limbs and giving the alarm to his cries. And before dawn he was delirious, and he had a dozen brothers around him, caressing him and soothing him, and leading him down a staircase that had opened in the bowels of the earth. It seemed that some time in the months that followed, Armand dreamed his master had not been burnt to death. He dreamed his master had fallen from the roof, a blazing comet, into the saving waters of the canal below. And deep in the mountains of northern Italy, his master survived. His master called to him to come. His master was in the sanctuary of those who must be kept. Sometimes, in the dream, his master was as powerful and radiant as he had ever been. Beauty seemed his raiment. And at others he was burnt black and shriveled, a breathing cinder, his eyes huge and yellow, and only his white hair as lustrous and full as it had been. He crept along the ground in his weakness, pleading for Armand to help him. And behind him, warm light spilled from the sanctuary of those who must be kept. There came the smell of incense, and there seemed some promise of ancient magic there, some promise of cold and exotic beauty beyond all evil and all good. But these were vain imaginings. His master had told him that fire and the light of the sun could destroy them, and he himself had seen his master in flames. It was like wishing for his mortal life to come again to have these dreams. And when his eyes were open on the moon and the stars, and the still mirror of the sea before him, he knew no hope, and no grief, and no joy. All those things had come from the Master, and the Master was no more. "I am the devil's child." That was poetry. All will was extinguished in him, and there was nothing but the dark confraternity, and the kill was now of the innocent as well as the guilty. The kill was above all cruel. In Rome, in the great coven in the catacombs, he bowed before Santino, the leader, who came down the stone steps to receive him with outstretched arms. This great one had been born to darkness in the time of the Black Death, and he told Armand of the vision that had come to him in the year 1349, when the plague raged, that we were to be as the Black Death itself, a vexation without explanation, to cause man to doubt the mercy and intervention of God. Into the sanctum, lined with human skulls, Santino took Armand, telling him of the history of the vampires. "From all times we have existed, as wolves have, a source of mortals. And in the coven of Rome, dark shadow of the Roman Church, lay our final perfection." Armand already knew the rituals and common prohibitions. Now he must learn the great laws. 1. That each coven must have its leader, and only he might order the working of the dark trick upon a mortal, seeing that the methods and the rituals were properly observed. 2. That the dark gifts must never be given to the crippled, the maimed, or to children, or to those who cannot, even with the dark powers, survive on their own. Be it further understood that all mortals who would receive the dark gifts should be beautiful in person, so that the insult to God might be greater when the dark trick is done. 3. That never should an old vampire work this magic, lest the blood of the fledgling be too strong. For all our gifts increase naturally with age, and the old ones have too much strength to pass on. Injury, burning, these catastrophes, if they do not destroy the child of Satan, will only increase his powers when he is healed. Yet Satan guards the flock from the power of old ones, for almost all, without exception, go mad. In this particular, Let Armand observe that there was no vampire then living who was more than 300 years old. No one alive then could remember the first Roman coven. The devil frequently calls his vampires home. But let Armand understand here also that the effect of the dark trick is unpredictable, even when passed on by the very young vampire and with all due care. For reasons no one knows, some mortals, when born to darkness, become as powerful as titans. Others may be no more than corpses that move. That is why mortals must be chosen with skill. Those with great passion and indomitable will should be avoided, as well as those who have none. 4. That no vampire may ever destroy another vampire, except that the coven master has the power of life and death over all of his flock. And it is, further, his obligation to lead the old ones and the mad ones into the fire when they can no longer serve Satan as they should. It is his obligation to destroy all vampires that are not properly made. It is his obligation to destroy those who are so badly wounded that they cannot survive on their own. And it is his obligation, finally, to seek the destruction of all outcasts and all who have broken the laws. 5. That no vampire shall ever reveal his true nature to a mortal and allow that mortal to live. No vampire must ever reveal the history of the vampires to a mortal and let the mortal live. No vampire must commit to writing the history of the vampires or any true knowledge of vampires lest such a history be found by mortals and believed. And a vampire's name must never be known to mortals, save from his tombstone. And never must any vampire reveal to mortals the location of his or any other vampire's lair. These, then, were the great commandments, which all vampires must obey. And this was the condition of existence among all the undead. Yet Armand should know that there had always been stories of ancient ones, heretic vampires of frightening power who submitted to no authority, not even that of the devil, vampires who had survived for thousands of years. Children of the millennia, they were sometimes called. In the north of Europe there were tales of Mael, who dwelt in the forests of England and Scotland, and in Asia Minor the legend of Pandora, and in Egypt the ancient tale of the vampire Ramses, seen again in this very time. In all parts of the world one found such tales, and one could easily dismiss them as fanciful, save for one thing. The ancient heretic Marius had been found in Venice, and there punished by the children of darkness. The legend of Marius had been true, but Marius was no more. Armand said nothing to this last judgment. He did not tell Santino of the dreams he had had. In truth, the dreams had dimmed inside Armand, as had the colours of Marius's paintings. They were no longer held in Armand's mind or heart, to be discovered by others who might try to see. When Santino spoke of those who must be kept, Armand again confessed that he did not know the meaning of it. Neither did Santino, nor any vampire that Santino had ever known. Dead was the secret. Dead was Marius. And so consigned to silence the old and useless mystery. Satan is our Lord and Master. In Satan all is understood and all is known. Armand pleased Santino. He memorized the laws, perfected his performance of the ceremonial incantations, the rituals and the prayers. He saw the greatest sabbats he was ever to witness, and he learned from the most powerful and skillful and beautiful vampires he was ever to know. He learned so well that he became a missionary, sent out to gather the vagrant children of darkness into covens, and guide others in the performance of the sabbat, and the working of the dark trick, when the world and the flesh and the devil called for it to be done. In Spain, and in Germany, and in France, he had taught the dark blessings and dark rituals, and he had known savage and tenacious children of darkness, and dim flames had fled in him in their company, and in those moments when the coven surrounded him, comforted him, deriving its unity from his strength. He had perfected the act of killing beyond the abilities of all the children of darkness that he knew. He had learned to summon those who truly wished to die, He had but to stand near the dwellings of mortals and call silently to see his victim appear. Old, young, wretched, diseased, the ugly or the beautiful, it did not matter because he did not choose. Dazzling visions he gave, if they should want to receive. But he did not move towards them, nor even close his arms around them. Drawn inexorably towards him, it was they who embraced him. And when their warm, living flesh touched him, when he opened his lips and felt the blood spill, he knew the only surcease from misery that he could know. It seemed to him in the best of these moments that his way was profoundly spiritual, uncontaminated by the appetites and confusions that made up the world, despite the carnal rapture of the kill. In that act, the spiritual and the carnal came together, and it was the spiritual, he was convinced, that survived. Holy communion, it seemed to him, the blood of the children of Christ serving only to bring the essence of life itself into his understanding for the split second in which death occurred. Only the great saints of God were his equals in this spirituality, this confrontation with mystery, this existence of meditation and denial. Yet he had seen the greatest of his companions vanish, bring destruction upon themselves, go mad. He had witnessed the inevitable dissolution of covens, seen immortality defeat the most perfectly made children of darkness. And it seemed at times some awesome punishment that it never defeated him. Was he destined to be one of the ancient ones, the children of the millennia? Could one believe those stories which persisted still? Now and then a roaming vampire would speak of the fabled Pandora, glimpsed in the far-off Russian city of Moscow, or of Mael, living on the bleak English coast. The wanderers told even of Marius, that he had been seen again in Egypt or in Greece. But these storytellers had not themselves laid eyes upon the legendary ones. They knew nothing, really. These were often repeated tales. They did not distract or amuse the obedient servant of Satan. In quiet allegiance to the dark ways, Armand continued to serve. Yet in the centuries of his long obedience, Armand kept two secrets to himself. These were his property, these secrets, more purely his than the coffin in which he locked himself by day, or the few amulets he wore. The first was that no matter how great his loneliness, or how long the search for brothers and sisters in whom he might find some comfort, he never worked the dark trick himself. He wouldn't give that to Satan, no child of darkness made by him. And the other secret, which he kept from his followers for their sake, was simply the extent of his ever-deepening despair. That he craved nothing, cherished nothing, believed nothing finally, and took not one particle of pleasure in his ever-increasing and awesome powers, and existed from moment to moment in a void broken once every night of his eternal life by the kill. That secret he had kept from them as long as they had needed him, and it had been possible to lead them because his fear would have made them afraid. But it was finished. A great cycle had ended. And even years ago he had felt it closing without understanding it was a cycle at all. From Rome there came the garbled travellers' accounts, old when they were told to him, that the leader Santino had abandoned his flock. Some said he had gone mad into the countryside, others that he had leapt into the fire, others that the world had swallowed him, that he had been borne off in a black coach with mortals, never to be seen again. "We go into the fire, or we go into legend," said a teller of the tale. Then came accounts of chaos in Rome, of dozens of leaders who put on the black hood and the black robes to preside over the coven, and then it seemed there were none. Since the year 1700, there had been no word any more from Italy. For half a century, Armand had not been able to trust to his passion or that of the others around him to create the frenzy of the true Sabbat. And he had dreamed of his old master, Marius, in those rich robes of red velvet, and seen the palazzo full of vibrant paintings, and he had been afraid. Then another had come. His children rushed down into the cellars beneath Les Innocents to describe to him this new vampire, who wore a fur-lined cloak of red velvet, and could profane the churches and strike down those who wore crosses and walk in the places of light. Red velvet. It was mere coincidence, and yet it maddened him, and seemed an insult to him, a gratuitous pain that his soul couldn't bear. And then the woman had been made, the woman with the hair of a lion and the name of an angel, beautiful and powerful as her son. And he had come up the stairway out of the catacomb, leading the band against us, as the hooded ones had come to destroy him and his master in Venice centuries before. And it had failed. He stood dressed in these strange lace and brocade garments. He carried coins in his pockets. His mind swam with images from the thousands of books he had read, and he felt himself pierced with all he had witnessed in the places of light in the great city called Paris, and it was as if he could hear his old master whispering in his ear, "But a millennium of nights will be yours, to see light as no mortal has ever seen it, to snatch from the distant stars as if you were Prometheus, an endless illumination by which to understand all things." "All things have eluded my understanding," he said. "I am as one whom the earth has given back. And you, Lestat and Gabriel, are like the images painted by my old master in cerulean and carmine and gold." He stood still in the doorway, his hands on the backs of his arms, and he was looking at us, asking, silently, "What is there to know? What is there to give? We are the abandoned of God, and there is no devil's road spinning out before me, and there are no bells of hell ringing in my ears." 4. An hour passed, perhaps more. Armand sat by the fire. No marks any longer on his face from the long-forgotten battle. He seemed, in his stillness, to be as fragile as an emptied shell. Gabrielle sat across from him, and she too stared at the flames in silence, her face weary and seemingly compassionate. It was painful for me not to know her thoughts. I was thinking of Marius. And Marius, and Marius. The vampire who had painted pictures in and of the real world, triptychs, portraits, frescoes on the walls of his palazzo. And the real world had never suspected him, nor hunted him, nor cast him out. It was this band of hooded fiends who came to burn the paintings, the ones who shared the dark gift with him. Had he himself ever called it the dark gift? They were the ones who said he couldn't live and create among mortals, not mortals. I saw the little stage at Renault's, and I heard myself sing, and the singing become a roar. Nicholas said, "It is splendid." I said, "It is petty." And it was like striking Nicholas. In my imagination, he said what he had not said that night. "Let me have what I can believe in. You would never do that." The triptychs of Marius were in churches and convent chapels, maybe on the walls of the great houses in Venice and Padua. The vampires would not have gone into holy places to pull them down, so they were there somewhere, with a signature, perhaps, worked into the detail, these creations of the vampire who surrounded himself with mortal apprentices, kept a mortal lover from whom he took the little drink, went out alone to kill. I thought of the night in the inn when I had seen the meaninglessness of life, and the soft, fathomless despair of Armand's story seemed an ocean in which I might drown. This was worse than the blasted shore in Nicky's mind. This was for 3 centuries, this darkness, this nothingness. The radiant, auburn-haired child by the fire could open his mouth again, and out would come blackness like ink to cover the world. That is, if there had not been this protagonist, this Venetian master, who had committed the heretical act of making meaning on the panels he painted, it had to be meaning, and our own kind, the elect of Satan, had made him into a living torch. Had Gabrielle seen these paintings in the story as I had seen them? Did they burn in her mind's eye as they did in mine? Marius was travelling some route into my soul that would let him roam there forever, along with the hooded fiends who turned the paintings into chaos again. In a dull sort of misery, I thought of the traveller's tales, that Marius was alive, seen in Egypt or Greece. I wanted to ask Armand, wasn't it possible? Marius must have been so very strong. But it seemed disrespectful of him to ask. "Old legend," he whispered. His voice was as precise as the inner voice. Unhurriedly he continued, without ever looking away from the flames. "Legend from the olden times, before they destroyed us both." "Perhaps not," I said. Echo of the visions, paintings on the walls. "Maybe Marius is alive." "We are miracles or horrors," he said quietly, "depending upon how you wish to see us. And when you first know about us, whether it's through the dark blood or promises or visitations, you think anything is possible. But that isn't so. The world closes tight around this miracle soon enough, and you don't hope for other miracles. That is, you become accustomed to the new limits, and the limits define everything once again. So they say Marius continues. They all continue somewhere. That's what you want to believe." "Not a single one remains in the coven in Rome from those nights when I was taught the ritual. And maybe the coven itself is no longer even there. Years and years have passed since there was any communication with the coven. But they all exist somewhere, don't they? After all, we can't die." He sighed. "Doesn't matter," he said. Something greater and more terrible mattered, that this despair might crush Armand beneath it. That in spite of the thirst in him now, the blood lost when we had fought together, and the silent furnace of his body healing the bruises and the broken flesh, he could not will himself into the world above to hunt. Rather suffer the thirst and the heat of the silent furnace. Rather stay here and be with us. But he already knew the answer, that he could not be with us. Gabrielle and I didn't have to speak to let him know. We did not even have to resolve the question in our minds. He knew, the way God might know the future, because God is the possessor of all the facts. Unbearable anguish. And Gabrielle's expression all the more weary, sad. "You know that with all my soul I do want to take you with us," I said. I was surprised at my own emotion. "But it would be disaster for us all." No change in him. He knew. No challenge from Gabrielle. "I cannot stop thinking of Marius," I confessed.
"I know. And you do not think of those who must be kept, which is most strange."
"That is merely another mystery," I said. "And there are a thousand mysteries. I think of Marius, and I'm too much the slave of my own obsessions and fascination. It's a dreadful thing to linger so on Marius, to extract that one radiant figure from the tale."
"Doesn't matter. If it pleases you, take it. I do not lose what I give."
"When a being reveals his pain in such a torrent, you are bound to respect the whole of the tragedy. You have to try to comprehend. And such helplessness, such despair is almost incomprehensible to me. That's why I think of Marius. Marius I understand. You I don't understand."
"Why?"
Silence. Didn't he deserve the truth? "I've been a rebel always," I said. "You've been the slave of everything that ever claimed you."
"I was the leader of my coven."
"No, you were the slave of Marius, and then of the Children of Darkness. You fell under the spell of one, and then the other. What you suffer now is the absence of a spell. I think I shudder that you caused me so to understand it for a little while, to know it as if I were a different being than I am."
"Doesn't matter,"
he said, eyes still on the fire. You think too much in terms of decision and action. This tale is no explanation, and I am not a being who requires a respectful acknowledgment in your thoughts or in words. And we all know the answer you have given is too immense to be voiced, and we all three of us know that it is final.